happens. I mean, I don't think that's really what we're called to be a part of. Yeah.
Well, I had read that. I read that sermon a lot of times, but I guess I read it with more perception today than previously, and really, really liked it a lot.
I just came back from a conference. The United Methodist Church General Board of Global Ministries is developing restating the theology of their board. Why do we have a board of missions? And I was invited to that. It was held over here in an airport motel with representatives from the Methodist in the West, and found myself saying some things there about theologically understanding what does it mean for us even to do mission, to be missionaries. You know, that's a tough one today. So many countries tell us, send your missionaries home.
Did you have any discussion about the new great boycott?
Not there, no. The Board of Church and Society deals with that, rather than this group. There are two groups, the Board of Church and Society, which is the general board, and then the General Council on Ministries, which is a general programmatic council for the United Methodist Church. Those two tend to deal with social issues. The Board of Global Ministries deals with social issues, but it tends to not want to co-opt those things from the others and spends more time on the relationship of empowerment to oppressed peoples in Central America, and you know, it's more of a worldwide focus.
I wanted to ask you, kind of incidentally, I understand that the Northern and Southern California representatives from Methodist Church are working on something concerning the new Great Boycott.
Yes,
they formed. Through the Church and Society, though.
That's right.
Are you aware of what's happening on that?
I'm not directly involved, and I kind of get it after the fact. Mm-hmm. I could get more information. I heard recently, I think John Moore is being asked to chair or be a part of something.
Moyer? John Moyer?
No, John Moore.
Moore.
He's a United Methodist.
Okay.
And Chris would know who that was. John, in the midst, not in the early days, but at one point in the original grape strike, John, and I was in a church down in Tulare County.
This was 61?
Yeah, where within a year I met the King's Tulare County had a migrant ministry program. And I'm trying to think of the fellow's name, and I can't remember his name. But he was in that, he was, I think, a disciple. And he was serving that particular function in that King's Tulare. And I heard of him or some way, and we connected. And I was in this very small church up in the foothills. It didn't even have any farmers. It had a few cattle ranchers in it. Then I went to Lindsay.
Oh, that's, and what was the name of that place?
Springville.
Springville, oh, I know Springville.
Above Porterville.
Sure.
And I was just, there was a community Methodist church. And but I had that fellow come up there because we had a hospital in Springville that's now become a senior citizen's place, but it was a county hospital. And a lot of county poor people came there. And so I had some sense, he was dealing with such things as planning birth control and planning family and health issues as a part of his migrant ministry work. And I just, somehow I felt that made sense. I can remember anyway. We got connected. Then through him I began to learn about, I had come to California, and then I learned about the larger, Northern Southern Council of Churches having that commission on migrant ministry. And then that's when I met Chris. And I met Chris at some place and learned about it probably 6 months before Caesar walked out of the fields in that strike in 65, mm-hmm. in September. And I had gone to Lindsay in 64.
Mm-hmm.
I was there
about
a year. And what I started to say when talking about this reconciliation is I have about three or four families that I count some of my closest, dearest friends out of that parish. And they are still growers, and that's their livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a depth of relationship that we have that has to do with how people can care about one another as human beings, mm-hmm. and maybe not see eye to eye totally about economic, social, political issues, but still able to understand deeply how those affect human beings and how the Christian community holds us together in spite of that. Because that's really what was going on in the Lindsay Church. Although the Lindsay Church had they had orange growers, so they had people that really were not ever going to be affected by the kind of activity that would need to be done for farm workers.
Were they smaller holdings?
Yeah. In those days, you used to be able to have 80 acres of oranges and make a living. And 80 acres, they had crews, but the crews could do it mm-hmm. in a couple of weeks, and they worked with those contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to point out the evils of those mm-hmm. contractors, and they agreed. But they really didn't have other options much.
Right.
I mean, the way they would deal with contractors who would bring the orange pickers in and they'd go through and pick their oranges. And so there wasn't that kind of investment in a sense of terrible opposition. At the same time, their mentality, they were reading things by like the California grower and those agricultural mediums and periodicals that were just horribly anti-labor. The editorials and every other one seemed like was anti-church, because the editors picked up on the, I can still remember that these farmers would, in fact, one even subscribed for me a year of reading that, because he wanted me to read it. But their particular circle of relationships was all being affected by a anti-church, that the church should not deal in these matters, but they didn't agree with it. Whoops. I often felt at that time that there was a whole new possibility for the church, and this is what I remember talking at the time, and Chris got excited when Chris and I would have a conversation. He would get excited hearing me as a pastor of a church not making the decisions he was making in terms of under a particular appointment to a particular call to a particular ministry to a particular group of people. But I said, for instance, that it informed my ministry as a pastor. For instance, for me, the issues were raised when a grower came into a meeting and he had a newspaper in his hand and he was kind of shaking it. He was angry and he was shaking it and saying, and he opened it up and it was, I think, probably Bakersfield newspaper. And it had a photograph showing a clergy person on a picket line at the time of the grape strike. And he said something like, what in the world does a clergyman have a right to be doing this kind of thing? Or some such language. And I can remember saying, and this was just before a Methodist men's were to eat dinner together. It was about 25 men. And I said, well, Bob, why do you presume to tell me what a clergyman ought to be doing? And he And I said, how is it if I were to start telling you how to farm, you'd wonder why, what, have I lost my mind? So you're telling me though where, and so I said, let's engage everybody in the conversation. Where is the presumption? Let's just put it up on the blackboard. What is the role of a clergy person? What is the role of the church? You see, and so it became pedagogically possible to say, have we understood that? Or have we done anything about that? What is the church as, what are we trying to do here as a church? And I did not try to become a economic expert or a wage expert on how much the workers should earn. And I had a few colleagues, a few liberal colleagues, who got enmeshed in trying to become, which is all right, they try to become labor arbitrators and all that. My sense is that's not the choice when the primary, for me, the primary calling was to be the pastor of that group of people. Mm-hmm. But in a way, that also meant I was not, they were not my alter ego. There was nothing that I needed to be doing to kind of get back from them support and strokes. And that's a deceptive thing that a lot of ministers spend a lot of time in their life trying to figure out. You know, it's like, that experience early in my ministry has helped to shape me in all the rest of these years in terms of that. That one does not need to be a reflection of values back to people is very, very critically important in terms of what preaching is all about, in terms of what ministry is all about. So for me, it would be like, you know, when they'd say, the church has no business being involved. And the next question for me is, what does a church have business getting involved in? Okay, you've just said they don't have any business in that. What is it? And then that would engage us in dialogue. And many of them, when they realized, I guess their Methodist roots and some of them were enough that when they started sounding like using cliches about, well, spiritual things, learning about religion, and then as a Methodist, you can ask the question, and that has nothing to do with the way we live in society. Something in them begins to say, well, there's something wrong there, isn't there? Because they know better. I mean, Methodism has always said to them, even that there is a relationship between what they know as a Christian and what they're being, what they're worshiping God for, and what they're learning as disciples, in terms of an intersection with their life. Mm-hmm. So that's not unreasonable for them to want to have a conversation around that at all.
Your congregation in Lindsay, what was the sort of the general demographics of the congregation?
At that time, it was primarily made up of small business persons and growers, and teachers. And I suppose you would call them some kind of like professional, semi-professional persons. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a small segment of that wasn't a very large church, that were retired persons. And there was about, I would estimate the congregation maybe had 10%, 10 to 20%. What we would call blue-collar mm-hmm. people. And I can still recall there was a motion. The most critical thing happened in that church around this was a motion made in an administrative board meeting by a grower who moved a motion, and I can't remember the wording, but in effect was in opposition to the church. And so it was going to go, it was something they wanted to direct to the annual conference. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the opposition to the church being supportive of what was happening in the organization of foreign workers. And I opened a discipline, and the Methodist discipline has a paragraph in support of collective bargaining. And so I read the paragraph and I said first what the discipline was for us, and then I said, a motion like this, from my interpretation, is a motion that is in opposition to the right of collective bargaining, and therefore it could not be supported by Methodists who understood that collective bargaining had been an issue that had been already wrestled with in earlier decades in the 20th century, and that we supported it. So the motion passed, but three people voted against the motion, and five people abstained. And it was a small board, so my guess was like about 12 or 13 voted in favor. So that was like, that was the most critical. I still remember having real troubled feelings when it was over, and everybody wanted to go out to the ice cream parlor and eat ice cream and make sure that nobody was going to really have these kind of anger feelings at each other. And there was that strong mood in that church. Not even though we would have that kind of, that was the, to me, that meeting was the strongest evidence of a real difference. Mm-hmm. Now, within a year, annually the budget gets adopted. I still remember talking to Chris about this, and they made a motion to raise my salary, and he said that ought to be published far and wide, that you can actually still survive and even have a raise in salary be proposed in a church that had, you know, strong differences.
So did that motion by the grower then go to the annual meeting?
Yes.
Or the annual conference?
Yes, it was mailed in a letter. That particular grower himself was a rather... he wasn't a very easy person to work with or talk with. He had strong emotional feelings. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, however, a man in the congregation who was the lay member to the annual conference meeting became a member of the conference board of church and society. At my insistence that he consider being a part of that. And now this man was a grower all his life, Republican, strong Republican. The last time I saw him, this is the kind of relationship I was going to tell you about. The last time I saw him, he gave me this and told me to read it because he thought it was probably the most important book that he had ever read.
The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Shell.
And he really is concerned. He's an older man, but he really is concerned. He's got some lovely grandchildren, and he thinks we've gone crazy in terms of the militarism, which is a real interesting thing. But I see the roots of that in his maturing back in those days there when I was ministering with him. I really do.
An ability to take a kind of an independent view of things. It was not some kind of a party line view.
Mm-hmm. He became a member of the Conference Board of Church and Society, heard different issues like concern for Vietnam War and those kind of things, and I don't think he had yet, you know, quite had that kind of a forum. Mm-hmm. Had always just been a businessman and counted the days take as a part of what, you know, I mean, that's, I don't mean to be too negative, but I think he just hadn't been exposed to a wider world.
And those exposures are really a critical factor.
And
where would any of us be if, you know, if we hadn't been exposed to whatever we've been exposed to?
That's
it's
right.
Shaped us. So how long were you in Lindsay?
I was only there another year. I was appointed there from 64 to 67.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to the commission on migrant ministry and was moved to Clovis. The Clovis Church is a suburb of Fresno, and I can recall I even let it be known that I was a member of that commission. And I can recall there was only one family. Well, there are two families now, as I think about it. One of them, for some reason, he worked for the highway department in the state of California, but he was upset about a pro farm worker stance. That was larger, that church. Lindsay Church was a little over 200, and the Clovis Church was about 500. So I was in effect promoted, as they say in Methodism. But the church congregation was made up of a whole different kind of group of people, and so and very few farmers or agricultural related persons. So that issue was not at all as affecting them, but there was one. I still remember one who was really not a farmer, but he sold farm implements, mm-hmm. and he had a big industry, and still does. He is retired, and he was very, very angry at the thought that the workers would organize. My guess is he's just totally free. What I would call him, a laissez-faire capitalist, is what he really was. Mm-hmm. And that's where it came from, in terms of his view of the world. But then I was in Clovis and served on that commission and was there 5 years.
The Meyer Ministry Commission.
Yes, until it, I can't even remember now, but we had the commission for a period of time. And we structure changed someplace along in there.
Yeah,
you may know more about that.
1970, January of 71, CMM went out and the National Farm Worker Ministry came in.
Right.
Would that have been
right.
during your time in Clovis?
Yes. I was on the CMM, and then when that changed, I wasn't a part of it any longer.
Mm-hmm.
That's when that happened. I was serving on the Conference Board of Church and Society, and we did hold conference forums, and I was a part of the... I was part of the conference at the time. I was looking this up the other day for another, because of what you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting distressed in hearing that the conference was acting as though it hadn't done mm-hmm. anything. I chaired this committee.
What year was this?
This must have been 1970. Let's see if I can pinpoint that. Thatcher, or whatever it meant, that they could invest in me mm-hmm. to chair that committee mm-hmm. from the conference was important. And then the conclusion, which I marked in yellow, there was a difference of opinion in the committee primarily in support of the boycott. That's when it had moved at that level, you know, national boycott. The majority of the committee supports the present efforts of the migrant ministry. It's a logical extension of their continued presence with farm workers in their struggle. See, people tried to split the difference, say, well, it's all right for them to work. I mean, even liberals, well, it's all right for them to work for a union. I'm not sure I agree about them calling for church people in all the cities and towns to be a part of a boycott.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we were trying to say, that is a logical extension. And a minority of the committee is opposed to support of the boycott, and therefore would advise against continuing support of the president. The minority would recommend removal of Northern California Council of Churches from the conference benevolence budget. To be listed, they wanted to put it in a recommended item, whereas we had it in the regular budget.
Mm-hmm.
After our study, we felt we probably would reflect opinions that are held in our churches. You can see my style even right there. You see, I didn't come in with a recommended resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Simply, my style was to state this and to work with it and to say, this is what the committee is. This is where the committee comes out. And the majority is still supportive in the majority of the, and therefore we informed the conference to continue to function as it was.
And could I get a copy of this?
You can take that one.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Then, let's see what this was. I was doing a little research. A committee was at that same time as the other one, and this was the Board of Christian Social Concerns, and so there was this smaller group called Labor and Market Relations. They recommended requesting the Council of Churches reconsider its support of the Great Boycott that was overruled by the board. So the board's report to the conference is showing that there was a small division within, but that the board affirmed the right of individuals to organize or to engage in collective bargaining, urged the extension of the LRA to include farm workers, urged enforcement of federal minimum wage laws, called upon growers, workers, and the public. So that just meant, again, that we had a small minority that were in opposition, but that the conference, this is what I was doing this research for the other day, to make clear that our conference has that kind of historical commitment, and any attempt in today to back away from that turns back at a time when it was much more heated, when we really had worked it through. So it's a bit, it was a bit surprising to me that was happening.
Okay, so this was also 1970, and this would have been really part of the same activity as this case. Is that what you're saying?
It was a part of the atmosphere of the conference at that time. Yes, this is the appropriate board.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, that deals with it. That mm-hmm. committee I had been a special committee mm-hmm. set up by the conference that I was asked to be a part of, and then, you know, as a part of it, I had earliest conference action. This is 1966, and that was the earliest action. I don't know why I only have one copy. So
it simply reaffirmed the historic position of the United Methodist Church for the right of employees and employers alike to organize for collective bargaining.
Yes. Yeah. See, that was the tactic that I was a part of, influencing to use that as the discipline of our church had that kind of language, and we were saying that's exactly what was taking place. And you either support self-determination and the rights of people to do that, or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and a lot of euphemistic language was used to try to say there was something else. We don't like violence. On, you know, you have to ask the question, who's perpetrating what violence and all that. But
mm-hmm. why do you think it's so difficult for some people in the church to, I think a lot of people in the church, to grasp this concept of Christians adding their weight to the side of the poor in a struggle in order to help the help reconciliation to come about?
The question has a seems to me a big area to explore in terms of why. I used to say that if I went back to graduate school to get a PhD, the area that I would deal in is what changes behavior. I'm pretty much convinced that preaching sermons doesn't change behavior. I'm pretty much convinced that even good, healthy dialogue of issues does not change behavior. So for me, when I asked that myself that kind of question, you just asked me why there is that resistance. Where I come to is that people get shaped in their almost like a gestalt of social political view of the world. They get shaped in that. Before, or I don't know chronologically, I mean necessarily before, but it seems to take place as a primary shaping before the religious shaping. And, or before their religious values and convictions. And that's why somehow there is that commitment to some people, even in this church I now pastor, I'm sure, have a very uninformed view of that shaping take place? Is it at their mom and dad's knee? Is there something almost in the in the way they're raised? because it does seem sometimes to be so primary. Mm-hmm. So basic. So that their religious questions don't often get integrated. So then when the church starts in some kind of a way of saying we ought to take a stand here, that is a new thing for them. It's like startling. It's like, really? I made a statement a few weeks ago in a sermon. And the statement on the face of it may seem like a harmless enough statement. The statement in the context of what I was preaching, I said something like, with regard to nuclear armaments, I said something like, investment and commitment to them, but I said it better than this in the sermon, and therefore we are making a commitment to destroying half the earth. And I went on, and I can't even remember exactly. I was just doing a kind of a categorical kind of statement about mm-hmm. three or four things, and a woman wrote a note to me and said, why do you always refer to our nuclear armaments as attack weapons when it's very clear that the only reason we're doing them is to defend our nation? Now, it's very clear is the way she says it. It's not clear to me at all, you know. And in fact, from what I read and understand, that a lot of what we do design is attack material and not designed for defensive material. And it's ambiguous at least. But I would even be willing to say to her, there's, and we haven't had a chance to have that dialogue, but I'm planning to. At least ambiguous, isn't it, in terms of that? But you know, for her, there's no ambiguity, and for me, even in preaching, it would seem like it would be clear that she ought to expect to come to a church and hear values about preservation of life. Mm-hmm. But she didn't like that, you see. And I give her credit for being, you know, bold enough to let me know mm-hmm. that she didn't like it. My guess is that there are a lot of people. We in fact have employees of the Livermore Lab in the church here. I'm sure that there are things I say that cause that kind of reaction. So the question of where they get shaped before the religious values began to impinge is for me the issue. And therefore, do I have an investment that behavior would change? I use the word behavior. I'm pretty much convinced that thinking doesn't necessarily precede action. Mm-hmm. I've lived long enough to begin to say, I don't know where I first heard it, but I think I heard this kind of statement a long time ago, and I like it. I did read it recently woman theologian.
Rosemary Ruther?
I started to say Rosemary Ruther, but I'm not sure if it's her. It might be. Anyway, that we ought to act ourselves into a new way of thinking rather than think ourselves into a new way of acting. And most of us had some kind of education that told us you think yourself into a new way of acting. And a lot of people, when it comes to social issues, they really do, I think, learn a lot by acting, putting their life involved. Then the thinking begins to follow from that. But there's a lot of frightened, no, we can't do that. We can't. People are, and you know what the language is. As soon as you pose a statement that is obviously biased in favor of, for something, in our egalitarian, democratic way, somebody will say, we need to hear the other side. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just as night follows day, that's a statement that's going to be made. Mm-hmm. We need to hear the other side. And I want to say why. You know? Now, I usually end up as a minister allowing the other side to be heard, but it's like there are things I don't need to hear the other side about. I mean, I'm clear about that because of my values. Now, there are times when I need to be startled and shocked out of that. I don't need to be so absolutely convinced about things. And I am not an absolutist, as it turns out. I've never been, I guess I call myself a nuclear pacifist, but I'm not an absolute pacifist. The lessons of World War II, which I learned afterwards because I was just a child, but would be convincing enough for me to realize that the church was wrong in its isolationism and separatism and its calling for not being involved in what was going on in Europe. That was clearly strategically wrong to have been so invested in an idealism that was not appropriate at the time of what was going on there. I don't. You know, it's a horrible thought, but I mean that's clearly that we needed to be involved there because of the Holocaust and what was going on. And our we still have, I think, deep guilt about that. But nuclear weaponry is a whole. The reason I think the shift, the reason why one can't have a pro-nuclear is that what happens is it's the fabric of life itself that's being threatened.
Right.
It's not a matter simply a matter of defense or armaments with regard to some kind of world police force. It's much more that the whole fabric of civilization is threatened. Mm-hmm. And so you just can't. There can't be a... So in that sense, I really do have a different pacifism about that.
Now, on the issue of the conflict that arose in the church and some of these other issues related to that,
I don't think so. I think clearly that you perceived, as we first started talking, the actual. I still feel that having commitments and having values reflected in commitments is to be affirmed and supported for the for reconciliation, that it's not that kind of somehow dispassionate neutrality that will ever be helpful in any, whatever those issues are. And, that's a false premise that does get made from time to time on the kind of like, we can't go anyplace because we need to remain neutral, whatever people mean by that. That sounds so exciting even to say it.
Would you still hold with what I perceive to be your major premise in that 1970 sermon, that reconciliation is not something that we do, but that it is the fruit of our servanthood? You would still hold with that?
Yes.
I thought that was a very significant sort of a new or fresh point that you made in that sermon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that it's the, you know, it's the reconciling activity of God that actually is doing its work, mm-hmm. while we do what we're called to be, which is servants.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. Very definitely.
Well, I do plan to mention that because I have a whole section on reconciliation that I'm working on right now, and I'm going to use that.
What's the actual title of your...
Well,